Sheridan. He then obtained letters of introduction to the three generals and to the post commanders at Fort Laramie and Cheyenne. 2 hours later, they were back at the train station, ready to continue westward. At the departure gate, a rough-looking man, very tall, with a peculiar slanting scar on his cheek, said to Johnson, "How far are you going?"
"I'm on my way to Wyoming."
As soon as the words were out of his mouth, he remembered he should have said Colorado instead.
"Wyoming. Good luck to you, then," the man said, and turned away.
Marsh was beside Johnson a moment later.
"Who was that?"
"I've no idea."
"What did he want?"
"He asked how far I was going."
"Did he? And what did you say?"
"Wyoming." Marsh frowned.
"Did he believe you?"
"I've no idea."
"Did he seem to believe you?"
"Yes, Professor, I think so."
"You think so?"
"I am fairly sure, Professor." Marsh stared off in the direction of the departed man. The station was still crowded and busy. The echoing din was loud, pierced by departure whistles.
"I have already warned you about talking to strangers," he said finally. "The man you spoke to was Cope's favorite foreman, Navy Joe Benedict, a brutal thug of a human specimen. But if you told him we were going to Wyoming, that is all right."
"You mean we are not going to Wyoming?"
"No," Marsh said. "We are going to Colorado."
"Colorado?"
"Of course," Marsh said. "Colorado is the best source of bones in the West, though you can't expect a fool like Cope to know it."
Going West. The Chicago and Northwestern Railway carried them across the Mississippi at Clinton, Iowa, over a 12-span iron bridge nearly a mile long. The students were excited to cross the largest river in America, but once its great muddy expanse was behind them, their lethargy returned. Iowa was a region of rolling farmlands, with few landmarks and points of interest. Dry heat blew in through the windows, along with an occasional insect or butterfly. A dreary, perspiring tedium settled over the party. Johnson hoped to glimpse Indians, but saw none. A passenger beside him laughed.
"There haven't been Indians here for 40 years, since the Black Hawk War. You want Indians, you have to go west."
"Isn't this the West?" Johnson asked.
"Not yet. Cross the Missouri."
"When do we cross the Missouri?"
"Other side of Cedar Rapids, half a day on."
But already the open prairie, and the fact of having crossed the Mississippi, had an effect on passengers. At each station and refueling stop, men would step onto the platform and fire their pistols at prairie dogs and prairie fowl. The birds would go screeching into the air. The little rodents would dive for cover, chattering. Nobody ever hit anything.
"Yep," said one passenger. "They're feeling the wide open spaces now."
Johnson found the wide open spaces extraordinarily tedious. The students amused themselves as best they could with cards and dominoes, but it was a losing battle. For a while they would get out at each station and walk around, but eventually even the stations became monotonously the same, and they usually remained inside. At Cedar Rapids, the train stopped for 2 hours, and Johnson decided to stretch his legs. Rounding the corner of the tiny station, which stood at the edge of wheat fields, he saw Marsh talking quietly to the scarred man. Cope's man, Navy Joe Benedict. Their manner seemed familiar. After a time, Marsh reached in his pocket and handed something to Benedict. Johnson saw a flash of gold in the sunlight. He ducked behind the corner before being spotted and hurried back to the train. When the train resumed, Johnson's perplexity increased as Marsh immediately came to sit beside him.
"I wonder where Cope will go this summer," Marsh said, as if thinking aloud.
Johnson said nothing. I wonder where Cope will go, Marsh said again.
Very good question, Johnson said.
I doubt that he, like us, is going to Colorado.
I wouldn't know.
Johnson was beginning to tire of this game and allowed himself to stare directly into Marsh's eyes, holding his gaze.
Of course not, Marsh said quickly. Of course not.
They crossed the Missouri in early evening at Council Bluffs, the terminus for the Chicago and Northwestern Railway. Across the bridge, on the Omaha side, the Union Pacific Railroad took over and continued all the way to San Francisco. The Union Pacific Depot was a great open shed, and it was packed with travelers of the rudest sort. Here were rugged men, painted women, border ruffians, pickpockets, soldiers, crying children, food vendors, barking dogs, thieves, grandparents, gunfighters. A great, confused mass of humanity, all fairly glowing with the fever of speculation.
Black Hillers, Marsh explained. They outfit here before they go to Cheyenne and Fort Laramie, and from there travel northward to the Black Hills in search for gold.
The students, impatient for a taste of the real West, were delighted and imagined that they too had become more real themselves. But despite the fevered excitement, Johnson found the sight sad. In his journal he recorded, "The hopes of humanity for wealth and fame, or at least for creature comfort, can delude them so easily. For surely only a handful of the people here will find what they are seeking. And the rest will meet with disappointment, hardship, sickness, and perhaps death from starvation, Indians, or marauding robbers who prey on the hopeful questing pioneers." And he added the ironic note, "I am most heartily glad that I am not going to the dangerous and uncertain Black Hills."
The West.
Beyond Omaha, the real West began, and aboard the train, everyone felt renewed excitement, tempered by the advice of older travelers. No, they would not see buffalo. In the 7 years since the transcontinental rail lines opened, the buffalo had disappeared from view along the rail side, and indeed the legendary great herds of animals were fast disappearing altogether. But then came the electrifying cry.
Indians!
They ran to the opposite side of the car, pressed their faces to the glass. They saw three teepees in the distance, surrounded by a half dozen ponies and dark silhouetted figures, standing and watching the train go by. Then the Indians were gone, vanished behind a hill.
"What tribe are those?" Johnson asked. He was sitting next to Marsh's assistant, Gall.
"Pawnee, probably," Gall said indifferently.
"Are they hostile?"
"Can be."
Johnson thought of his mother.
"Will we see more Indians?"
"Oh, yes," Gall said. "Lots of 'em where we're going."
"Really?"
"Yes. And probably riled up, too. There's going to be a full-on Sioux war over the Black Hills."
The federal government had signed a treaty with the Sioux in 1868, and as part of that treaty, the Dakota Sioux retained exclusive rights to the Black Hills, a landscape sacred to them. "That treaty was unnecessarily favorable to the Sioux," Gall said. "The government even agreed to remove all forts and army outposts in the region." And it was a huge region, for in 1868, the Wyoming, Montana, and Dakota territories still seemed distant and unapproachable wilderness. No one in Washington had understood how quickly the West would open up. Yet 1 year after the treaty had been signed, the transcontinental railroads began service, providing access in days to land that could previously be reached only by weeks of difficult overland travel. Even so, the Sioux lands might have been respected had not Custer discovered gold during a routine survey in the Black Hills in 1874. News of gold fields, coming in the midst of a nationwide recession, was irresistible, even in the best times. There's no way to keep men from gold, Gaul said, and that's a plain fact. Although forbidden by the government, prospectors sneaked into the sacred Black Hills. The army mounted expeditions in 74 and 75 to chase them out, and the Sioux killed them whenever they found them. But still the prospectors came, in ever-increasing numbers. Believing the treaty had been broken, the Sioux went on the warpath. In May of 1876, the government ordered the army to quell the Sioux uprising. Then the Indians are in the right? Johnson asked. Gaul shrugged. You can't stop progress, and that's a plain fact. Will we be near the Black Hills? Gaul nodded. Near enough. Johnson's understanding of geography, always vague, allowed his imagination free rein. He stared out at the wide-stretching plains, which seemed suddenly more desolate and unappealing. How often do Indians attack white people? Well, they're unpredictable, Gaul said. Like wild animals, you never know what they'll do, because they're savages. West of Omaha, the train climbed steadily and imperceptibly as it entered the high plains leading to the Rocky Mountains. They saw more animals now, prairie dogs, the occasional antelope, and coyotes loping in the distance near sunset. The towns became smaller, more desolate. Fremont, Kearney Junction, Alkali, Oglala, Julesburg, and finally the notorious Sydney, where the conductor warned the students not to get off if they valued their lives. Of course, they all got off to look. What they saw was a line of wooden storefronts, a town composed, wrote Johnson, almost entirely of outfitters, stables, and saloons, and doing a brisk commerce in all three. Sydney was the town nearest to the Black Hills, and it was filled with emigrants, most of whom found prices outrageously high. The town's reputation for murder and cutthroat life was not demonstrated to us, but then we had only stopped an hour. But they were not long disappointed, because the Union Pacific train was now speeding them westward to a still more notorious locus of vice and crime. Cheyenne, Wyoming territory. Travelers loaded their six-shooters coming into Cheyenne, and the conductor took Marsh aside to recommend that his party hire a guard to see them safely through the town. Such preliminaries, wrote Johnson, gave us a most pleasurable nervous anticipation, for we imagined a lawless wild place, which proved to be just that, a figment of our imaginations. Cheyenne turned out to be a rather orderly and settled place, with many brick buildings among those of wood-frame construction, but it was not entirely peaceful. Cheyenne boasted one schoolhouse, two theaters, five churches, and 20 gambling saloons. A contemporary observer wrote that gambling in Cheyenne, far from being merely an amusement or recreation, rises to the dignity of a legitimate occupation, the pursuit of 9/10 of the population, both permanent and transient. Gambling halls were open around the clock and provided the major source of revenue to the town. Some indication of the business they did can be judged from the fact that the proprietors paid the city a license of $600 per year for each table, and each saloon had 6 to 12 Green Bay's tables going at once. The enthusiasm for gambling was not lost on the students as they checked into the Inter-Ocean Hotel in Cheyenne, where Marsh had previously arranged a special rate. Although the best hotel in town, it was, noted Johnson, a cockroach-infested dump where the rats scurry up and down the walls, squeaking at all hours. Nevertheless, each student was given a private room, and after soaking in hot baths, they were ready for a night on the town. A Night in Cheyenne. Timid, they set forth as a group, 12 earnest young Downeasters still wearing their high collars and bowler hats, strolling from saloon to saloon with as much nonchalance as they could muster. For the town, which had appeared disappointingly tame by day, assumed a positively sinister aspect at night. In the yellow light of the saloon windows, the boardwalk crowd of cowboys, gunmen, gamblers, and cutthroats looked at them with amusement. "These varmints would kill you as soon as smile at you," said one student melodramatically. Feeling the unfamiliar weight of their new Smith & Wesson revolvers dragging at their hips, the students tugged at their guns, adjusting their weight. One man stopped them. "You look like nice fellers," he told the group. "Take some friendly advice. In Cheyenne, don't touch your guns lest you mean to use them. Round here, people don't look at your face, they look at your hands. And a great deal of drinking is done in these precincts at night." There were not only gunfighters on the boardwalk. They passed several nymphs du pavé, heavily painted, calling out teasingly to them from dark doorways. Altogether, they found it exotic and thrilling, their first experience of the real West, the dangerous West they had been waiting for. They entered several saloons, sampled the harsh liquor, played hands of keno and 21. One student pulled out a pocket watch. "Nearly 10, and we haven't seen a shooting yet," he said, with a tinge of disappointment. Within minutes, they saw a shooting. "It happened astonishingly fast," Johnson noted. One moment, angry shouts and curses. The next moment, chairs scraped back and men ducking away while the two principals snarled at each other, though they were just a few feet apart. They were both gamblers of the roughest sort. "Make your move, then," one said, and as the other went for his pistol, the first drew his gun and shot him right in his abdomen. There was a great cloud of black powder, and the shot man was thrown back across the room by the impact, his clothes burning from the close shooting. He bled heavily, moaned indecipherably, twitched for a minute, then lay quite dead. Some of the others hustled the shooter out. The town marshal was summoned, but by the time he arrived, most of the gamblers had returned to their tables, to the games that had been so recently interrupted. It was a cold-blooded display, and the students, no doubt in shock, were relieved when they heard the sound of music from the theater next door. When several gamblers left the tables to see the show, they followed hurriedly along to see this next attraction. And here, unexpectedly, William Johnson fell in love. The Pride de Paris Theater was a two-story triangular affair with the stage at the wide end, tables on the floor, and balconies mounted high on the walls at both sides. Balcony seats were the most expensive and desirable, though they were farthest from the stage, and so they bought those. The show, observed Johnson, consisted of singing, dancing, and petticoat flouncing, the rudest sort of entertainment, but the assembled patrons greeted it with such enthusiastic cheers that their pleasure infected our more discriminating tastes. Soon enough they learned the value of balcony seats, for overhead were trapeze bars, on which swung comely young women in scanty costumes and mesh tights. As they arced back and forth, the men in the balconies reached out to tuck dollar bills into the folds of their costumes. The girls appeared to know many of the customers, and there was a deal of good-natured banter high in the air, the girls crying, "Watch them hands spread, and mighty big cigar you got there, Clem," and other endearments. One student sniffed, "They are no better than prostitutes." But the others enjoyed the spectacle, shouting and tucking dollar bills with the rest, and the girls, seeing new faces and distinctive Eastern clothes, maneuvered their swings to come close to their balcony again and again. It was all good fun, and then the girls overhead changed to a new set, and the swinging began again, and one of them came close to their balcony. Laughing, Johnson reached for another dollar bill, and then his eyes met those of the new girl, and the raucous sound of the theater faded away, and time seemed to stop. and he was aware of nothing but the dark intensity of her gaze and the pounding of his own heart. Her name was Lucienne. It's French, she explained, wiping the light sheen of perspiration from her shoulders. They were downstairs, sitting at one of the floor tables, where the girls were allowed to have a drink with customers between shows. The other students had gone back to the hotel, but Johnson stayed, hoping Lucienne would come out. And she had. She had sashayed right to his table. Buy me a drink? Anything you want, Johnson said. She ordered whiskey, and he had one too. And then he asked her name, and she told him. Lucienne, he repeated. Lucienne. A lovely name. Lots of girls in Paris are named Lucienne, she announced, still wiping the perspiration. What's yours? William, he said. William Johnson. Her skin glowed pink. Her hair was jet black. Her eyes dark and dancing. He was entranced. You look a gent, she said, smiling. She had a way of smiling with her mouth closed, not revealing her teeth. It made her seem mysterious and self-contained. Where are you from? New Haven, he said. Well, I grew up in Philadelphia. Back east. I thought you were different. I could tell from your clothes. He worried that this might not find favor with her, and suddenly didn't know what to say. Do you have a sweetheart back east? She asked innocently, helping the conversation along. He stopped, then thought it best to tell her the truth. I was awfully fond of a girl in Philadelphia a few years ago, but she didn't feel the same way about me. He looked into her eyes. But that was a long time ago. She looked down and smiled softly, and he told himself that he must think of something to say. Where are you from? He asked. You don't have a French accent. Perhaps she had come from France as a child. I'm from St. Louis. Lucienne's only my name to stage, see? She said cheerfully. Mr. Barlow, the manager. Mr. Barlow wants everyone in the show to have a French name, because the theater is the Pride de Paris Theater, see? He's very nice, Mr. Barlow. Have you been in Cheyenne long? Oh, no, she said. Before I was in the theater in Virginia City, where we did proper plays by English writers and such. But that closed with the typhoid last winter. I was going home to see my mother, see? But I only had money to get here. She laughed, and he saw one of her front teeth was chipped. This little imperfection only made him love her more. She was obviously an independent young woman, making her own way in life. And you? She asked. Are you going to the Black Hills, looking for gold? He smiled. No. I am with a group of scientists who were digging for fossils. Her face clouded. Fossils. Old bones, he explained. Is there a good livelihood in that? No, no. It's for science, he explained. She placed a warm hand on his arm, and the touch electrified him. I know you gold diggers have secrets, she said. I won't tell. Really? I am searching for fossils. She smiled again, content to drop the matter. And how long are you in Cheyenne? Alas, I am here for only one night. Tomorrow I leave to go farther west. This thought already filled him with a delicious pain, but she did not seem to care one way or another. In her straightforward way, she said, I must do another show in an hour and stay with the customers another hour after that. But then I am free. I'll wait, he said. I'll wait all night if you wish it. She leaned over and kissed him lightly on the cheek. Until then. And she swept away, across the crowded room, where other men awaited her company. The rest of the evening passed as lightly as a dream. Johnson felt no fatigue, and he was happy to sit until she was finished with her performances. They met outside the theater. She had changed to a demure dress of dark cotton. She took his arm. A man passed them on the sidewalk, in the darkness. See you later, Lucy? Not tonight, Ben, she laughed. Johnson turned to glare at the man, but she explained, It's just my uncle. He looks after me. Where are you staying? The Interocean Hotel. We can't go there, she said. They're very strict about the rooms. I'll walk you home, Johnson said. She gave him a funny look, and then smiled. All right. That would be nice. As they walked, she rested her head on his shoulder. Tired? Some. The night was warm, the air pleasant. Johnson felt a wonderful peace descend over him. I'm going to miss you, he said. Oh, me too. I'll be back, though. When? Late August or so. August, she repeated softly. August. I know it's a long time away. Not so long. But I'll have more time to spend then. I'll leave the party and stay with you. How does that sound? She relaxed against his shoulder. That would be nice. They walked in silence. You're nice, William. You're a nice boy. And then she turned, and with complete naturalness, kissed him on the mouth. Right there in the warm western darkness of Cheyenne, in a deep way he had never yet experienced, Johnson thought he would die with the pleasure of it all. I love you, Lucienne, he blurted. The words just came out, unbidden, unexpected. But it was the truth. He felt it through his whole body. She stroked his cheek. You were a nice boy. He did not know how long they stayed like that, facing each other in the dark. They kissed again, and a third time. He was breathless. Shall we walk on? He said finally. She shook her head. You go on home now. Back to the hotel. I'd better see you to your door. No, she said. You have a train in the morning. You get your sleep. He looked around at the street. Are you sure you'll be all right? I'll be fine. Promise? She smiled. Promise. He walked a few steps toward his hotel, turned, and looked back. Don't worry about me, she called, and blew him a kiss. He blew a kiss back to her, and walked on. At the end of the block, he looked back once again. But she was gone. At the hotel, the sleepy night clerk gave him his key. Good evening, sir, he asked. Wonderful, Johnson said. Absolutely wonderful. Morning in Cheyenne. Johnson awoke at 8, refreshed and excited. He looked out his window at the flat expanse of Cheyenne, boxy buildings stretching across the plains. By all accounts, it was a dreary sight, but Johnson found it beautiful. And the day was lovely, clear and warm, with the fluffy high clouds peculiar to the west. It was true that he would not see the beautiful Lucienne for many weeks until his return trip, but this fact added a delicious poignancy to his mood, and he was in excellent humor when he went downstairs to the dining room, where the Marsh party had been instructed to meet for breakfast at 9. No one was there. A table had been set for a large group, but the dirty plates were being collected by a waiter. Where is everybody? Johnson asked. Who do you mean? Professor Marsh and his students. They're not here, the waiter said. Where are they? Gone an hour or more. The words sank in slowly. The professor and the students are gone? They went to catch the 9 o'clock train. What 9 o'clock train? The waiter looked at Johnson irritably. I have a lot to do, he said, turning away, rattling the plates. Their bags and expedition equipment had been stored in a large room on the ground floor of the hotel, behind the reception desk. The bellboy unlocked the door. The room was empty, except for the crates containing Johnson's photographic equipment.
They're gone!
Something of yours missing? The bellboy said.
No, not mine. But everyone else is gone.
I just came on duty, the bell captain said apologetically. He was a boy of 16. Perhaps you should ask at the desk. Oh, yes, Mr. Johnson, said the man at the front desk. Professor Marsh said not to wake you when they departed. He said you were leaving the expedition here in Cheyenne.
He said what?
That you were leaving the expedition. Johnson felt panic.
Why would he say that?
I really don't know, sir.
What am I going to do now?
Johnson asked aloud. The distress must have been apparent in his face and voice. The man at the front desk looked at him sympathetically. They're serving breakfast in the dining room for another half hour, he suggested. He had no appetite, but he returned to the dining room and took a small table to one side. The waiter was still clearing dishes from the bare table. Johnson watched, imagining the group of Marsh and the students, imagining their excited voices talking at once, ready to leave. Why had they left him behind? What possible reason could there be? The bellboy approached him.
Are you with the Marsh expedition?
I am. The professor asked if he might join you for breakfast. In an instant, Johnson realized that it was all a mistake after all, that the professor had not gone. The hotel staff had merely misunderstood. Everything was going to be all right. With immense relief, he said, "Of course he may join me." A moment later, a clear, rather high voice said, "Mr. Johnson." Johnson faced a man he had never seen before. A wiry, fair-haired man with a mustache and goatee stood next to his table. He was tall, in his middle 30s, and rather formally dressed in stiff collar and frock coat. Although his clothes were expensive and well-cut, he nevertheless gave the impression of an energetic indifference, even sloppiness. His eyes were bright and lively. He appeared amused.
"May I join you?"
"Who are you?"
"Don't you know?" the man said, more amused than ever. He extended his hand. "I'm Professor Cope."
Johnson noticed that his grip was firm and confident, and his fingers stained with ink. Johnson stared and leapt to his feet. Cope. Cope himself. Right here in Cheyenne. Cope eased him back into his seat and beckoned to the waiter for coffee.
"Don't be alarmed," he said. "I'm not the monster you have heard described.
That particular monster exists only in the diseased imagination of Mr. Marsh. Yet another of his descriptions of nature is in error. You must have observed that the man is as paranoid and secretive as he is fat, and always imagines the worst in everybody.
More coffee?"
Numbly, Johnson nodded. Cope poured more coffee.
"If you haven't ordered, I recommend the pork hash. I myself eat it daily. It is simple fare, but the cook has a feel for it."
Johnson mumbled he would have the hash. The waiter departed. Cope smiled at him. He certainly didn't look like a monster, Johnson thought. Quick, energetic, even nervous. But no monster. On the contrary, there was a youthful, almost childish enthusiasm about him, yet also an air of determination and competence. He seemed like a man who got things done.
"What are your plans now?" Cope asked cheerfully, stirring a dollop of black molasses in his coffee.
"I'm not supposed to talk to you."
"That hardly seems necessary now that the old schemer has left you behind. What are your plans now?"
"I don't know. I have no plans."
Johnson looked around the nearly empty dining room. "I seem to have been separated from my party."
separated. He abandoned you.
Why would he do that? Johnson asked.
He thought you were a spy, of course.
But I'm not a spy.
Cope smiled.
I know that, Mr. Johnson, and you know that. Everyone knows that, except Mr. March. It is just one of the many thousands of things he does not know, yet assumes he does.
Johnson was confused, and it must have shown on his face.
Which fantasy did he tell you about me? Cope asked, still cheerful. Wife-beater, thief, philanderer, axe-murderer. The whole business seemed to amuse him.
He doesn't have a high opinion of you.
Cope's inky fingers fluttered in the air, a dismissing gesture. Marsh is a godless man, cut loose from all moorings. His mind is active and sick. I have known him for some time. In fact, we were friends once. We both studied in Germany during the Civil War, and later we dug fossils together in New Jersey, in fact. But that was a long time ago. The food came. Johnson realized that he was hungry.
That's better, Cope said, watching him eat.
Now I understand that you are a photographer. I can use a photographer. I am on my way to the Far West to dig for dinosaur bones with a party of students from the University of Pennsylvania.
Just like Professor Marsh, Johnson said.
Not quite like Professor Marsh. We do not travel everywhere with special rates and government favors. And my students are not chosen for wealth and connection, but rather for their interest in science. Ours is not a self-aggrandizing publicity junket, but a serious expedition.
Cope paused, studying Johnson's earnest attention.
We're a small party, and it will be rough going. But you are welcome to come, if you care to.
And that was how William Johnson found himself, at noon, standing on the platform of the Cheyenne Railroad Station with his equipment stacked at his side, waiting for the train to carry him west, in the party of Edward Drinker Cope.
Cope's Expedition. It was immediately clear that Cope's party lacked the military precision that characterized Marsh's every undertaking. His group straggled into the station singly and in pairs. First, Cope and his charming wife Annie, who greeted Johnson warmly and would not be drawn to say anything against Marsh, despite the prompting of her husband. Then a barrel-chested man of 26 named Charles H. Sternberg, a fossil hunter from Kansas who had worked for Cope the previous year. Charlie Sternberg walked with a limp, the result of a childhood accident. He could not shake hands because of a felon, a fistula in his palm. And he was subject to occasional bouts of malaria, but he exuded an air of practical competence and wry humor. Next, another young man, J.C. Isaac. It just stands for J.C., who was Indian shy. 6 weeks earlier, he had been among a party of friends attacked by Indians. The others had been shot down and scalped, and only Isaac escaped, leaving him with a deep fear and a facial tick around the eyes. There were three students, Leander Toad Davis, a puffy, asthmatic, bespectacled boy with protuberant eyes. Toad was particularly interested in Indian society and seemed to know a lot about it. And George Morton, a sallow, silent young man from Yale who sketched constantly and announced that he intended to be an artist or a minister like his father. He wasn't sure yet. Morton was withdrawn, rather sullen, and Johnson did not care for him. And finally, Harold Chapman from Pennsylvania. A brightly talkative young man with an interest in bones. After being introduced to Johnson, he almost immediately wandered off to poke through some bleached buffalo bones stacked near the station platform. Johnson's favorite of the group was the lovely Mrs. Cope, who was anything but the deluded invalid Marsh had claimed. She would accompany them only as far as Utah. Then the six men, with Johnson making seven, would set out for the Judith River Basin of northern Montana Territory,
to hunt for Cretaceous fossils. Montana, Johnson said, remembering what Sheridan had said about staying away from Montana and Wyoming. Do you really mean to go to Montana? Yes, of course. It's tremendously exciting, Cope said, his face and manner radiating his enthusiasm. No one has been there since Ferdinand Hayden discovered the area back in 55 and noted great quantities of fossils. What happened to Hayden? Johnson asked. Oh, he was driven off by the Blackfeet, Cope said. They made him run for his life. And Cope laughed. West with Cope. Johnson awoke in inky blackness, hearing the roar of the train. He fumbled for his pocket watch. It said 10 o'clock. For a confused moment, he thought it was 10 at night. Then the darkness broke with a shaft of brilliant light, and another, and flickering shafts illuminated his sleeping compartment. The train was thundering through long snow sheds as it crossed the Rocky Mountains. He saw fields of snow in late June, the brilliance so dazzling it hurt his eyes. 10 o'clock! He threw on his clothes, hurried out of the compartment, and found Cope staring out the window, drumming his stained fingers impatiently on the sill. I'm sorry I overslept, Professor. If only someone had awakened me, I— Why? Cope asked. What difference does it make that you slept? Well, I mean, I— It's so late. We are still 2 hours from Salt Lake, Cope said. And you slept because you were tired. An excellent reason for sleeping. Cope smiled. Or did you think I would leave you too? Confused, Johnson said nothing. Cope continued to smile. And then after a moment, he bent over the sketch pad in his lap, took up his pen, and drew with his ink-stained fingers. Without looking up, he said, I believe Mrs. Cope has arranged for a pot of coffee. That night, Johnson recorded in his journal. Cope spent the morning sketching, which he does with great rapidity and talent. I have learned a lot about him from the others. He was a child prodigy who wrote his first scientific paper at the age of 6, and he is now, I believe him to be 36, published some 1,000 papers. He is rumored to have had a love affair before his marriage that was broken off, and then, perhaps in despair, he traveled to Europe, where he met many of the great natural scientists of the day. He met Marsh in Berlin for the first time and shared correspondence, manuscripts, and photographs. He is also considered to be an expert on snakes, reptiles, and amphibians in general, and fish. Sternberg and the students, except Morton, are devoted to him. He is a Quaker, and peace-loving to the core. He wears wooden false teeth, which are remarkably lifelike. I wouldn't have known. In this way and nearly every other, he is utterly different from Marsh. Where Marsh is plodding, Cope is brilliant. Where Marsh is scheming, Cope is honest. Where Marsh is secretive, Cope is free. In all ways, Professor Cope shows greater humanity than his counterpart. Professor Marsh is a desperate, driven fanatic who makes his own life as miserable as the lives of those he commands, while Cope shows balance and restraint, and is altogether agreeable. It would not be long before Johnson took a different view of Cope. The train descended out of the Rocky Mountains to Great Salt Lake City, in the territory of Utah. Established 30 years before, Salt Lake City was a village of wood and brick houses, carefully laid out in a regular grid pattern, and dominated by the white facade of the Mormon Tabernacle. A building, Johnson wrote, of such breathtaking ugliness that few edifices anywhere in America can hope to surpass it. This was a common view. Around the same time, the journalist Charles Nordoff called it an admirably arranged and very ugly building, and concluded that Salt Lake need not hold any mere pleasure traveler more than a day. Although Washington claimed this as the territory of Utah, and therefore a part of the United States, it had been established as a Mormon theocracy,
As the scale and importance of the religious buildings made clear, Cope's group visited the temple, the tithing house, and the lion house, where Brigham Young kept his multitudinous wives. Cope then had an audience with President Young, and he took his own wife with him to meet the elderly patriarch. Johnson asked what he was like.
"Gracious man, gentle and calculating.
For 40 years the Mormons were hounded and persecuted in every state of the Union. Now they make their own state, and persecute the Gentiles in turn."
Cope shook his head.
"You would think that people who had experienced injustice would be loath to inflict it on others, and yet they do so with alacrity. The victims become the victimizers with a chilling righteousness. This is the nature of fanaticism, to attract and provoke extremes of behavior. And this is why fanatics are all the same, whatever specific form their fanaticism takes."
"Are you saying Mormons are fanatics?" asked Morton, the minister's son.
"I am saying their religion has made a state that does not halt injustice, but rather institutionalizes it. They feel superior to others who have different beliefs. They feel only they possess the right way."
"I don't see how you can say," began Morton,
but the others jumped in. Morton and Cope were always at loggerheads on religious subjects, and the arguments became tedious after a while.
"Why did you see Brigham Young?" Sternberg asked.
Cope shrugged. "There are no known fossil deposits in Utah now, but there are rumors of bones in the eastern regions near the Colorado border. I see no harm in making friendships for the future." And he added, "Marsh met him last year."
The following day, Mrs. Cope took the Union Pacific train back east, while the men traveled north by narrow-gauge railway to Franklin, Idaho, an alkali flats town, Johnson noted, with nothing to recommend it save that rail and stage lines enable one to leave it as soon as possible. But in Franklin, while buying stagecoach tickets, Cope was suddenly accosted by the sheriff, a large man with small eyes.
"You are under arrest," he told Cope, taking him by the arm, "and charged with murder."
"Whom am I supposed to have murdered?" Cope asked, astonished.
"Your father," the sheriff said, "back east."
"That's ridiculous. My father died last year of a heart attack."
Despite being a Quaker, Cope was known for his flashing temper, and Johnson could see that he was doing his utmost to remain civil.
"I loved my father with all my heart. He was kind and wise and supportive of my irregular scholarly wanderings," he said with deep fury.
The sudden display of eloquence took everyone aback. The men all followed Cope and the sheriff to the jail from a polite distance. It turned out a federal warrant for his arrest had been filed in the Idaho Territory. It also turned out that the federal marshal was in another district and would not return to Franklin until September. "Cope," said the sheriff, "would have to cool his heels in jail until then." Cope protested that he was Professor Edward Drinker Cope, a United States paleontologist. The sheriff showed him the telegram stating that Prof. E. D. Cope, paleontologist, was the man wanted for murder.
"I know who is behind this," Cope said angrily. He was turning purple in the face. "Now, Professor," Sternberg said.
"I'm fine," Cope said stiffly. He turned to the sheriff. "I propose to pay the telegraph costs to verify that the charges against me are untrue." The sheriff spat tobacco. "That's fair enough. You get your father to cable me back and I'll apologize."
"I can't do that," Cope said.
"Why not?"
"I already told you. My father's dead."
"You think I'm a fool," the sheriff said, and grabbed Cope by the collar to drag him into the jail cell. He was rewarded by a series of lightning-swift punches from Cope that knocked him to the ground. Cope proceeded to kick the sheriff repeatedly, while the unfortunate man rolled in the dust, and while Sternberg and Isaac cried,
"Now, Professor! And that's enough, Professor! And remember yourself, Professor!"
At length, Isaac managed to drag Cope away. Sternberg helped the sheriff to his feet and dusted him off. "I'm sorry, but the professor has a terrible temper."
"Temper? The man is a menace."
"Well, you see, he knows that Professor Marsh sent you that telegram, along with a bribe to arrest him, and the injustice of your behavior makes him angry."
"I don't know what you're talking about," the sheriff sputtered, without conviction.
"You see," Sternberg said, "most places the professor goes, he encounters trouble from Marsh. Their rivalry has been going on for years now, and they are both able to spot it readily."
"I want all of you out of town," the sheriff shouted. "Do you hear me? Out of town!"
"With pleasure," Sternberg said. They left on the next stage. From Franklin, they faced a 600-mile journey on Concord Stagecoach to Fort Benton, Montana Territory. Johnson, who had thus far experienced nothing more arduous than a railway carriage, was looking forward to the romance of a coach ride. Sternberg and the others knew better. It was a horrible journey. 10 miles an hour, day and night, with no stops except for meals. Outrageously expensive at $1 each, and awful. And at every coach stop, everyone would talk of the Indian troubles and the prospect of scalping. So that if Johnson had had any desire for the coach stop's moldy army surplus bacon, the rancid butter, and the week-old bread, he lost his appetite. The landscape was uniformly dreary, the dust harshly alkaline. They had to walk up all the steep ascents, day or night. In the rattling, bouncing coach, sleep was impossible, and their chemical supplies leaked, so that at one point, we were subjected to a gentle rain of hydrochloric acid, which drops etched a smoking pattern on the hats of the gentlemen, and elicited elaborate curses from all involved. The coach was stopped, and the driver accorded our leftover curses. The offending bottle stopped, and we were on our way once more. Besides their group, the only other passenger was a Mrs. Peterson, a young woman married to an army captain stationed in Helena, Montana Territory. Mrs. Peterson seemed none too enthusiastic to be rejoining her husband. Indeed, she cried frequently. Often she opened a letter, read it, wiped tears from her eyes, and tucked it away again. At the last coach stop before Helena, she burned the letter, dropping it to the ground to dissolve into ash. When the stage reached Helena, she was formally met by 4 army captains, their demeanor grave. They escorted her away. She walked directly in their midst. The others stared after her. "He must be dead," Toad said. "That's what it's about. He's dead." At the coach station, they were told that Captain Peterson had been killed by Indians, and there were rumors of a recent major cavalry defeat at Indian hands. Some said General Terry had been killed along the Powder River, others that General Crook had narrowly escaped death on the banks of the Yellowstone, and that he had suffered blood poisoning from the arrows removed from his side. In Helena, they were urged to turn back, but Cope never considered it. "Idle talk," he said, "foolish talk. We will go on." And they climbed back aboard the coach for the long trip to Fort Benton. Located on the banks of the Missouri River, Fort Benton had been a trapper's refuge in the early days of the Montana Territory, back when John Jacob Astor was lobbying in Congress to prevent any legislation to protect the buffalo, and thus interfere with his lucrative trade in hides. Northern Montana was the source of other hides as well, including beaver and wolf, but now the fur trade was declining in importance, and the fastest-growing towns were located farther south, in the mining regions of Butte and Helena, where there was gold and copper. Fort Benton had seen better days, and looked it. As their stagecoach arrived on July 4, 1876, they saw that the army stockade gates were closed, and there was a general air of tension. The soldiers were gloomy and distressed. The American flag flapped at half-mast. Cope went to see the commanding officer, Captain Charles Ransom. What's the trouble? Cope asked. Why is your flag lowered?
7th Cavalry, sir.
What about it? Cope asked.
The whole of the 7th Cavalry under General Custer was massacred at the Little Bighorn last week. More than 300 Army dead. And no survivors.
Fort Benton. George Armstrong Custer remained as controversial in death as he had been in life. Old Curly had always been the focus of strong feelings. He had graduated last in his class at West Point, accumulating 97 demerits in his last half year, just 3 short of dismissal. Even as a cadet, he was making enemies who would dog him all his life. But the insubordinate cadet proved a brilliant military leader, the boy wonder of Appomattox. Handsome, dashing, and reckless, he went on to earn a reputation as a great Indian fighter in the West. But his reputation was debated widely. A dedicated hunter, he traveled with greyhounds wherever he went, and it was said that he took better care of his dogs than he did his men. In 1867, he ordered his troops to shoot deserters from his company. 5 men were wounded, and Custer refused them medical aid. 1 subsequently died. Even for the army, this was too much. In July 1867, he was arrested, court-martialed, and suspended for a year. But he was a favorite of the generals, and he was back 10 months later at Phil Sheridan's insistence, this time fighting the Indians along the Washita in the Oklahoma Territory. Custer led the 7th Cavalry against Black Kettle. His instructions were clear, to kill as many Indians as possible. General Sherman himself had said, "The more we can kill this year, the less we'll have to be killed the next year. For the more I see of these Indians, the more I am convinced they will all have to be killed, or be maintained as a species of paupers." It was a particularly vicious war. The Indians had been taking white women and children as hostages, whom they ransomed back to the settlers. Whenever soldiers attacked an Indian village, the white hostages were summarily executed. This circumstance excused the kind of dashing bravado that was, in any case, Custer's trademark. Forcing his troops on extended marches, foregoing food and rest, he ran down Black Kettle, killed the chief, and destroyed his village. Only then did he realize that Indians from surrounding villages were gathering for a massive counterattack, and that he had overextended himself and endangered all his troops. He managed to pull out, but left behind a company of 15 men, presuming them to be already dead. Later, the entire battle became embroiled in scandal. The Eastern press criticized Custer for his harsh treatment of Black Kettle's tribe, saying that Black Kettle was not a bad Indian, but a scapegoat for military frustrations. This was almost certainly untrue. The army criticized Custer for his hasty attack and his equally hasty abandonment of the cut-off company. Custer was unable to provide a satisfactory explanation for his behavior in the crisis, but he felt, with justification, that he had only done what the army had expected him to do, to run down the Indians with his usual dash and bravado. His personal style, his long curly hair, his greyhounds, his buckskin clothes, and his arrogant manner remained notorious, as did the articles he wrote for the Eastern press. Custer had a peculiar affinity for his enemy, and often wrote admiringly of the Indians. This was no doubt the source of the persistent rumor he had fathered a child by a beautiful Indian girl after the Battle of the Washita. And still the controversy continued. In 1874, it was Custer who led a party into the sacred Black Hills, discovered gold, and thus precipitated the Sioux War. In the spring of 1876, he had gone to Washington to testify against the corruption of Secretary of War Belknap, who received kickbacks for supplies from every army post in the country. His testimony had helped start impeachment proceedings against Belknap, but had not endeared him to the Grant administration,
which ordered him to remain in Washington, and when he left without permission in March, demanded his arrest. Now he was dead, in what was already being called the most shocking and humiliating military